Welcome to Rural Ed Med. I am Serena Wilson, an acute care nurse practitioner hospitalist, and I will be speaking about hyponatremia today. This lecture will be a little different than prior ones. Hyponatremia is such a huge topic that in the interest of time, I focus much less on history and current research and much more on pathophysiology. Andrea is an 86-year-old female with COPD who was admitted to the hospital with bilateral pneumonia. She is fairly spry for her age and lived independently before admit. She has mild hyponatremia despite receiving 1 liter of normal saline IV. Overnight, she reports headache and nausea. The nurse reports that she is very unsteady on her feet when she walks to the bathroom, which is new for her. You are concerned about SIADH, or Syndrome of Inappropriate Antidiuretic Hormone, related to pneumonia. According to Hannon and Thompson, 2010, about 8% of patients hospitalized for pneumonia develop SIADH during the course of their hospitalization, and those who do tend to have much higher mortality rates. How exactly does it happen? At what point do we worry? In this age of alarm fatigue, it is difficult to know how low is too low. It seems like every hospitalized patient has some derangement in sodium, especially. You find hyponatremia in cirrhosis patients and with a heart failure exacerbation. Those patients on antipsychotics and SSRIs always seem to have it. People taking some medications for hypertension, such as thiazides, are frequently hyponatremic. Everyone in the ICU has it, it seems, in an area where adrenal suppression runs rampant. And with such vague, common complaints like fatigue, headache, and nausea being associated with hyponatremia, when do we take it seriously? These are the same symptoms we find with infections, GI bleeds, cardiac disease, really anything that buys someone a hospitalization. Finally, and most importantly, how and when do we treat it? Sodium is a major extracellular cation. It is the interplay between sodium, potassium, and sometimes calcium moving in and out of the cells that maintains this massive electrical current that is responsible for what we call life. We can't have movement or thought or sensation without the rhythmic depolarizations and repolarizations that occur throughout the body, linking the various nerves, cells, and systems. The movement of sodium into the cell is what is responsible for bringing the resting membrane potential, usually about negative 70 millivolts, up to approximately positive 40 millivolts via the addition of positively charged ions. This process typically starts out as a slow leak of sodium across the membrane. When the membrane potential reaches a certain threshold level, then fast and numerous sodium channels open, leading to rapid depolarization. At another threshold level, the sodium channels once again close. The slow leak of potassium from within the cell to the extracellular area returns the membrane potential to its previously negative value. Because of the source functions of sodium, the body maintains it within a very narrow physiologic range. Sodium also is intimately involved with fluid balance and renal function within the body. Sodium is the major determinant of osmolality of body fluids. Osmolality is osmoles of solute. Again, often sodium is the major one measured, but any osmotically active ion or molecule can contribute to this number, per kilogram of solvent. Other things that contribute to osmolality are urea, glucose, potassium, chloride, and bicarbonate. The normal osmolality of body fluids is between 275 and 290 milliosmoles per kilogram. Body fluid osmolality can be measured with an osmometer or calculated with the formula 2 times the serum sodium plus serum glucose over 18 plus serum BUN divided by 2.8. The difference between these two values is known as the osmolar gap, and represents unmeasured osmotically active solutes, such as alcohols, mannitol, or glycine. Osmolality creates the gradient necessary for the movement of body water between compartments. This movement is necessary to maintain blood pressure and for immune and kidney functions, among others. The major compartments in the body include the intracellular and extracellular spaces, with the extracellular space made up of interstitial and intravascular spaces. The membranes that separate these spaces are highly permeable to water and less so to solutes. The result is movement of water between spaces according to osmotic forces, so that water tends to flow from compartments with low solute concentrations to areas of higher concentration. The result is a balancing of osmolalities. Now, this is not the only force determining the movement of water between compartments and does not happen in isolation, but for the sake of simplicity, we'll not go into oncotic and hydrostatic forces at this time. When we measure serum osmolality, it is the intravascular portion of the extracellular space only. In the setting of true hyponatremia, we will often have a low intravascular osmolality, which results in the movement of water from the vascular space into the more highly concentrated intracellular space. This includes all cells of the body, including central nervous system cells, which can result in cerebral edema and cellular swelling, impaired neurological functioning, and cell death. In a normal functioning body, urine output is determined by fluid intake and body water needs. The body keeps track of how much water is needed with a number of receptor systems. Osmoreceptors are specialized receptors in the hypothalamus that detect tonicity of the plasma. When tonicity is high, the hypothalamus stimulates the posterior pituitary to release antidiuretic hormone, or ADH, resulting in conservation rather than loss of body water via the kidneys. ADH is also known as arginine vasopressin and increases kidney collecting duct permeability to water, leading to greater water reabsorption than is usual. ADH also stimulates natriuretic peptide release, causing natriuresis or greater sodium loss. Low tonicity results in inhibition of ADH secretion. Baroreceptors monitor pressure changes and are located in the right atria of the heart and within the great veins. Low pressures also send signals to the hypothalamus, resulting in ADH release and conservation of water. Osmoreceptors are very sensitive to even small changes in tonicity. Baroreceptors are not as sensitive, but provide a much stronger hypothalamic stimulus. Low pressures will override a low tonicity alarm every time, and ADH release will be stimulated. Finally, there are specialized receptors contained within the macula densa of the kidneys that detect tonicity and stimulate the renin-angiotensin system in response to high tonicity, in addition to directly stimulating thirst at the level of the hypothalamus. The renin-angiotensin system is responsible for aldosterone release from the adrenal glands. This causes retention of sodium and water at the expense of potassium at the level of the kidneys. So now that we have introduced all the major players in hyponatremia, let's talk about the different kinds there are. Syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone, or SIADH, is considered to be a euvolemic hyponatremia involving low serum osmolality. If you remember, ADH secretion causes conservation of fluid at the level of the kidneys. Unlike with aldosterone, this does not involve concurrent conservation of sodium. Conservation of water without sodium leads to a dilutional hyponatremia. The resulting imbalance of intracellular and extracellular osmolality leads to cellular swelling. The excess water is in the cells, and so the vascular space remains euvolemic. No peripheral edema is present, as the fluid is not in the interstitial or any other portion of the extracellular space. In SIADH, excessive ADH secretion causes the urine osmolality to be maximally high. The body retains all the fluid that it can. Then urine output becomes dependent on solutes such as sodium, potassium, and urea. That is to say that all the excess sodium and potassium ingested in a day, as well as the amount of renally excreted waste products produced, determines how much water is necessarily lost in order to rid the body of these things, and with all other water retained by the body. Theoretically, you could increase dietary sodium and protein, urea is a major breakdown product of protein, and cause a patient with SIADH to excrete more water, thus lowering the body water and dilutional hyponatremia as long as water intake was restricted. Excessive ADH release can be caused by a number of factors. Any link in the chain of ADH production, storage, secretion, transport, and site of action can interfere with this process. So the process begins with the osmoreceptors on the hypothalamus, which, when stimulated, cause the posterior pituitary to release ADH. The hypothalamus and pituitary are within the cranial vault, a rigid space incapable of significant expansion. Anything that potentially compresses this area of the brain could interfere with normal ADH secretion. This includes stroke, intracranial bleed, hydrocephalus, and increased intracranial pressure. Later, ADH travels to the kidneys and attaches to V1 and V2 vasopressin receptors, causing increased surface aquaporin receptor expression on the collecting tubules. This increases permeability to water with resultant water reabsorption. Many drugs actually increase aquaporin receptor expression, much like ADH does. These include carbamazepine and fluoxetine, NSAIDs, and chlorpropamide. Pain and sympathetic stimulation have been shown to increase plasma levels of ADH. There are no studies showing why this is. It is hypothesized that it's somehow related to the fact that these things stimulate the reticular formation, ventral thalamus, and hypothalamus. Any stimulation of the hypothalamus could hypothetically result in increased ADH secretion. Pulmonary diseases such as pneumonia, acute respiratory failure, and even atelectasis can also cause SIADH, but the cause for this is not well understood, probably because of the rarity of which this occurs. Sometimes the cancers can produce and release ADH directly, including small cell lung cancers, head and neck cancers, and olfactory neuroblastomas. Cortisol has been shown to directly inhibit ADH secretion. Aldosterone deficiency leads to decreased circulating volume, stimulating baroreceptors. It makes sense, then, that adrenal insufficiency can also be associated with SIADH. Finally, hypothyroid can lead to increased ADH levels, possibly as a result of associated decreases in cardiac output, followed by baroreceptor stimulation and resulting decreases in glomerular filtration rate. There is some debate on whether or not hypothyroid is an actual cause of SIADH, however. In hyponatremia due to SIADH, you will usually see a weight gain from the retention of body water. On average, this amounts to a 5 to 10% increase in weight. Unfortunately, we usually do not have access to a pre-hyponatremic body weight. Patients often report lower than usual urine output. 400 to 500 milliliters in a 24-hour period is about average for people on a typical Western diet. Remember that urine water loss is dependent on the need to remove excess solutes and urea in this condition. Vasopressin conserves water but not sodium at the distal tubules, so urinary sodium is often high in the absence of diuretic use. Due to variations in urinary sodium elimination, there's no cutoff value for this. Some sources say urine sodium greater than 25 is consistent with SIADH, others say greater than 40. Urine osmolality will always be greater than the serum osmolality in this disorder. The serum will be more dilute than usual. Another common finding is low serum uric acid and high urinary uric acid. It turns out that the kidney vasopressin receptor V1 probably also increases uric acid clearance via a decrease in renal tubular reabsorption, in addition to uric acid being removed from the body at a higher rate, secondary to a higher glomerular filtration rate from increased body water associated with SIADH. This was shown with studies involving using the synthetic vasopressin drug DDAVP to induce SIADH. This synthetic vasopressin only acts on V2 receptors on the kidneys, rather than both V1 and V2. The end result is that DDAVP-induced SIADH is not accompanied by low serum uric acid. Andrea, with a bilateral pneumonia, was found to have a low serum osmolality and uric acid. Her urine osmolality was high, as was her urine sodium and uric acid. She had no peripheral edema. She was on no drugs known to contribute to SIADH, and she was already on appropriate antibiotic therapy. Should this patient be treated for hyponatremia? The rule of thumb is to treat those with a sodium less than 110 or less than 120 with neurological symptoms. The severity of hyponatremia signs should determine the treatment. Mental slowness, falls, and nausea are considered to be mild to moderate symptoms and usually correct with fluid restriction. More advanced symptoms such as somnolence, altered mental status, vomiting, and hallucinations will often require 3% saline or medications. Hyponatremia leading to seizures, stroke-like symptoms such as focal weakness or respiratory failure are a medical emergency, and treatment should always start with hypertonic saline as a first-line therapy. Andrea started on an 800 milliliter per day free water restriction, and her sodium returns to normal over the next couple of days. Second to treating the underlying cause, free water restriction is the first step in SIADH management. The exception to this is some neurological disorders, such as subarachnoid hemorrhage, in which hypovolemia may lead to cerebral vasospasms and acute worsening of neurological function. The amount of water to restrict is not well studied. Some sources suggest using a urine plasma electrolyte ratio to guide this choice. If the combination of urine sodium and potassium divided by the serum sodium is 1 or greater, no or minimal free water is given. If it is 0.5 or less, then the typical restriction is 1 liter per day. Pneumonia is a more rare cause of SIADH, so in this patient, other causes must be investigated. You want to be sure that the pneumonia you found is not actually lung cancer. You should make sure that her neurological changes are not due to a head injury, bleed, or stroke. You need to check the med list for common offending agents. By restricting free water intake to lessen output, the body will continue with obligatory solute and free water losses. As long as she is consuming enough solute to keep up her output, the hyponatremia should correct, even in the setting of continued ADH secretion. If fluid restriction is not enough to restore sodium levels, then sodium supplementation is next. You want to give a fluid with higher osmolality, mostly determined by sodium content, than is being eliminated in the urine. If your IV fluid doesn't add sodium to the serum above and beyond the urine sodium concentration, then you will end up giving more free water in a process known as desalination. Isotonic saline is actually hypotonic in comparison with the urine of most patients with SIADH, and when the concentration of sodium is pulled into the urine, it leaves free water. Under the influence of ADH, the kidneys continue to lose a normal amount of sodium, but the water loss is severely decreased. You want a fluid with less free water to hold on to and much more sodium than can be eliminated by the kidneys. A normal range for extracellular sodium is 135 to 134 or 145 milliequivalents per liter. Normal saline has approximately 154 milliequivalents per liter. Hypertonic saline has 513 milliequivalents per liter for the 3% solution. Lactated Ringer's is actually a slightly hypotonic fluid with 130 milliequivalents per liter and is not very useful in the correction of any type of hyponatremia. In the case of SIADH, normal saline characteristically will not correct the sodium, as it will in most other forms of hyponatremia. This is due to desalination. No formula to date has been shown to reliably predict how much 3% saline should be given to patients with SIADH. You can grossly estimate how much volume it will take to raise the serum sodium by 1 millimole per liter by using the patient's body weight as a rate per hour for the 3% saline. So an average-sized man of 70 kilograms would increase his sodium by 1 millimole per liter with a 3% saline solution, infusing at a rate of 70 milliliters per hour. Although there are many formulas out there, nothing is as effective as frequent monitoring of sodium levels. Initially, serum sodium should be obtained every 2 to 3 hours. This is important because of a thing called osmotic demyelination syndrome, or ODS. ODS is the major fear of using hypertonic saline. People do not receive it outside of the ICU for exactly this fear. Theoretically, if you reverse hyponatremia too quickly, excess water from the cells of the body, especially the nervous system cells, will flow back into the extracellular space in such a fashion that the cells will dehydrate and die. The recommended rate of sodium correction is less than 9 millimoles per liter in a 24-hour period. Studies have shown no cases of ODS with these correction rates. Some sources recommend to shoot for between 6 to 8 millimoles per liter, and others less than 12 in a 24-hour period still shows acceptable levels of risk. The brain cells adapt to hyponatremia, especially hyponatremia that develops over time, by decreasing their solute load in order to limit cerebral cell edema. They do this by unloading glutamate, chloride, glutamate, and to a smaller degree, sodium and potassium into the cerebrospinal fluid. It takes approximately 2 to 3 days for cerebral adaptation to occur. Unfortunately, when chronic hyponatremia is corrected rapidly, the brain cells are unable to regain their usual solutes in such a short amount of time, which results in more water being pulled out of the cells than was initially added. The now hypovolemic cells suffer damage to the blood-brain barrier, degenerate, and may die. It takes the brain even longer to regain its osmotically active solutes than it did to lose them. It makes sense then that those affected are usually people who have developed hyponatremia over long time frames or who are malnourished, such as alcoholics. Symptoms typically will not present for 2 to 6 days following overly rapid correction of hyponatremia and are usually irreversible. Manifestations are similar to those you would find in stroke, including paraplegia, paresthesias, altered mental status and confusion, locked-in syndrome, and rarely seizures. Based on animal studies, it is now recommended to reduce the sodium to a lower level if it drops faster than the recommended guidelines. This has been shown to ameliorate nervous system damage. This can be achieved by intake of free water without any or a very small sodium content, such as D5W IV, or drinking electrolyte-free water, or by giving a medication analog of ADH called desmopressin. Finally, there are some medications that can be used to treat SIADH. The most obvious one is ADH, or vasopressin receptor antagonists, which stop the effect of ADH at its source of action. These medications are known as vaptans, and they are more commonly used in hyponatremia due to cirrhosis or heart failure, although they've had FDA approval for the treatment of both euvolemic and hypervolemic hyponatremia since 2007. Some examples include tolvaptan and comivaptan. Studies have shown that in SIADH, vaptan use usually raises the serum sodium by about 4 millimoles per liter within 24 hours. Dimethylcycline is another medication that works by decreasing aquaporin 2 expression in the inner medulla of the kidneys, where the collecting tubules are located. Lithium also reduces kidney aquaporin expression, but it is rarely used in hyponatremia due to side effects. Now we move on to another type of euvolemic hypoosmolar hyponatremia, excessive free water intake. This can occur from psychogenic polydipsia, a psychological disorder in which a person feels that they need to drink massive amounts of water over the course of the day, from drugs that cause excessive thirst, such as ecstasy, and from beer potomania that occurs in heavy alcohol drinkers due to high consumption of the electrolyte-free fluid contained in beer without adequate nutrient intake. The term beer potomania was first coined in 1971 by a man named Demanet. Under normal circumstances, the kidneys are capable of excreting up to 20 liters of free water per day. This is dependent, however, on having enough solute load to support kidney function, which often alcoholics and other severely malnourished individuals may not have. There is a maximally dilute level that urine can be, requiring a minimum amount of solute to provide the osmolar pull of urine, usually about 50 milliosmoles per liter. An alcoholic who drinks a 24-pack of beer per day would need to excrete approximately 8 liters of free water per day. The beer itself does provide carbohydrates and a minimal amount of sodium and potassium. Malnourished people with low food intake will break down their protein stores, also providing some urea to provide solute. But typically all of this does not provide enough solute for elimination to completely rid them of all of the excess water they take in through beer. Every day their net gain of water may stay the same, but over time builds up to a level capable of causing severe hyponatremia. Because these causes of hyponatremia are not the result of a defective ADH feedback system, they will respond quite briskly to reintroduction of solutes, making them the highest risk patients for osmotic demyelination syndrome. For example, 1 liter of normal saline given would cause approximately 6 liters excretion of maximally dilute urine. Depending on the free water excess amount, this would likely result in a huge increase in the serum sodium level. For a normal 70-kilogram male with a free water excess of 5 liters, this would be a rise in sodium of well over the recommended 9 millimoles per liter correction in any 24-hour period, even over the 12 millimole level, recommended level. And 1 liter of normal saline is rarely given over a 24-hour period. The last types of euvolemic hyponatremia that deserve mention include that caused by hypothyroid and also by adrenal insufficiency. Hypothyroid is one cause that has been a source of debate in the literature. Hypothyroidism alone does not cause hyponatremia, rather it sets the stage for something else to more readily cause it. Thyroid is intimately related to metabolism and speed of functions. In the absence of adequate thyroid hormone, the processes of the body slow down, including the glomerular filtration rate of the kidneys. This makes the body less able to rid itself of excess free water. It also affects the sodium-potassium ATPase pump. Studies have shown that rats that have had their thyroid removed have kidneys that are less able to reabsorb sodium back into the serum. Adrenal insufficiency involves the inadequate secretion of cortisol and/or aldosterone. Aldosterone, a mineralocorticoid, causes sodium and water retention at the level of the kidney, which it retains in exchange for potassium and hydrogen, actually leading to a hypovolemic hyponatremia. In the case of cortisol deficiency, corticotropin releasing factor, or CRF, is actually released in tandem with ADH from the posterior pituitary. Cortisol release is stimulated by CRF, and then works as a negative feedback mechanism to limit further CRF and concomitantly ADH release. In the absence of adequate cortisol, ADH release becomes more uninhibited and leads to a condition quite similar to SIADH. These two types of hyponatremia are treated by replacing thyroid or cortisol hormones. Usually the hyponatremia in and of itself does not require separate treatment. You do still need to worry about osmotic demyelination syndrome with overly rapid correction, especially in the case of adrenal insufficiency. Now it's time to move on to our second cause of hyponatremia and the most easiest form to treat, hypovolemic. The causes of hypovolemic hyponatremia include body fluid losses, such as occurs with sweating, vomiting, diarrhea, GI suctioning, and kidney-related causes, such as occurs with diuretic use, mineralocorticoid deficiency, and osmotic diuresis. These are all of the things that may cause loss of body water and even more body solute concurrently. As with any condition that causes volume depletion, it is sensed by the baroreceptors, thus activating ADH secretion and conserving more free water than sodium. Obviously, loss of blood, sweat, and diarrhea contain a lot of electrolytes. Most diuretics cause calorimetric and natriuretic, or loss of potassium and sodium, in addition to fluid loss. Whereas thiazides are a common culprit, loop diuretics only rarely cause hyponatremia. Perhaps this is due to their sites of action. Loop diuretics act on the ascending loop of Henle, where urine is diluted by reabsorption of sodium and chloride to the interstitium, effectively creating a hyperosmolar gradient that allows normal action of ADH at the distal tubules. Loop diuretics lessen this sodium and chloride reabsorption, which decreases the interstitial gradient and makes it so that ADH has inadequate action on the kidneys to conserve free water in the face of volume depletion. Thiazides actually have an ADH-like effect of their own, in addition to actually stimulating ADH secretion with routine use. As mentioned previously, suppression or inadequate secretion of aldosterone interferes with a mechanism for retention of sodium and water. Finally, osmotic diuresis is having something in the extracellular space, such as hyperglycemia or mannitol, which cause movement of fluid from the cells to the vascular space and also cause diuresis with loss of fluids and electrolytes. Last of all, there is a neurologic injury-associated form of hypovolemic hyponatremia known as cerebral salt wasting. It is very similar to SIADH that occurs after neurologic injury. Cerebral salt wasting involves the loss of both extracellular fluid and sodium despite high ADH levels. The mechanism is unknown, but it always occurs in the setting of neurological injury or insult. It often leads to weight loss, orthostatic hypotension, and other symptoms of dehydration. Urine osmolality is greater than serum with this disorder. There is high urine sodium, and severe dehydration is evidenced by elevated blood urea nitrogen, hematocrit, and urine-specific gravity. Hypovolemic, hyponatremic patients will always have a urine osmolality that is greater than the plasma osmolality because the body is trying to conserve volume. There are, however, varying degrees of this. Patients on diuretics, using mannitol, or with hyperglycemia have losses via a mechanism that cause the kidneys to lose water in addition to electrolytes. Their urine osmolality will tend to be between 300 and 600 milliosmoles per liter. Those patients who are hyponatremic from excessive insensible water losses, such as with burns or sweating, or have lost other electrolyte-rich fluids, tend to have very high urine osmolalities, because the body has nothing counteracting its goal to conserve all available water. This value is usually greater than 600 milliosmoles per liter. Urine sodium also depends on the source for hypovolemia. Remember, certain drugs force natriuresis, so urinary sodium is high in this case. In aldosterone insufficiency, urinary sodium will also be high because it is not being conserved. In severe volume and electrolyte depletion, mineralocorticoids cause conservation of sodium and water, so in these cases, urine sodium will be low. Hypovolemic hyponatremia is corrected by restoring fluid balance. The first step is normal saline, which is usually sufficient. If this does not work, then one moves on to hypertonic saline. Vasopressin antagonists are not useful because ADH secretion is actually an adaptive response to hypovolemia. The last hyponatremia is hypervolemic. This one can be a bit confusing because often these patients are intravascularly depleted and yet still considered hypervolemic. Many people become way too focused on the intravascular space. With hypervolemic hyponatremia, we are referring to the extracellular space, which includes both the vascular and interstitial spaces. The intravascular space is quite dynamic, with constant fluid shifts of water and solutes in and out of this area, both to and from the intracellular and interstitial spaces. It is therefore often the interstitial space excess fluid with resultant edema and weight gain that is associated with this type of hyponatremia. You will find hypervolemic hyponatremia in a variety of conditions, including congestive heart failure, cirrhosis, and chronic renal failure. Urine sodium levels are often low secondary to the renal hypoperfusion associated with intravascular dehydration. Serum and urine will both be hypoosmolar or quite dilute. Whereas in hypovolemic, you replace fluids, in hypervolemic, you restrict them. In hyponatremia, the first step is determining serum osmolality. Serum osmolality is affected by other osmotically active solutes such as glucose, triglycerides, and protein. Glucose has very little effect on osmolality until it reaches between 200 and 300 milligrams per deciliter. Triglycerides do not affect these values until over 500. Protein probably has the largest effect. Every 8 grams per deciliter provides the same osmolar force as 4 milliequivalents per liter of sodium. Other typically unmeasured sources of osmotically active solutes can be determined by comparing the measured serum osmolality to the calculated one. True hyponatremia is accompanied by hypoosmolality because the sodium is the main source of osmotic forces and the sodium is low. Next, urine osmolality is measured. High values are usually considered to be greater than 100 to 150 milliosmoles per liter, and low is less than 100 to 150. The normal response to hyponatremia is suppression of ADH secretion with free water fluid losses or maximally dilute urine. Specific gravity of urine can be used as a gross estimation of urine osmolality, and in this case would be less than or equal to 1.003. Low urine osmolality is found in polydipsia, malnutrition, beer potomania, and following correction of hyponatremia, such as a fluid bolus for hypovolemia. This is why it is absolutely essential that urine osmolality be obtained before hyponatremia correction is attempted. Low urine osmolality is diagnostic, and when found, no further laboratory data is needed to determine cause. High urine osmolalities usually indicate a dysfunction such as SIADH, but can also indicate impaired renal handling of sodium with higher losses in the urine, such as occurs with cerebral salt wasting, mineralocorticoid insufficiency, and some forms of kidney disease. High urine osmolality is also found in syndromes of intravascular volume depletion, but not necessarily interstitial depletion, such as blood loss, cirrhosis, and CHF, as a result of appropriate ADH secretion. Urine sodium can be used to determine fluid status in the setting of the finding of high urine osmolality. Hypovolemic patients tend to have lower urine sodiums in comparison to euvolemic ones. Intravascular dehydration stimulates both ADH and mineralocorticoid secretion. While ADH does not conserve sodium, aldosterone does. The urine sodium will typically be less than 25 milliequivalents per liter in conditions such as excessive fluid losses, heart failure, and cirrhosis. You can extrapolate the cause from here with liver function, BNP, and patient history. Urine sodium greater than 40 milliequivalents per liter indicates SIADH or conditions of renal salt wasting such as mineralocorticoid deficiency, cerebral salt wasting, and intrarenal failure. Intermediate values may not provide much information on their own, but serial measurements in response to therapy may provide a clearer picture of the cause. Intermediate values in the setting of low urinary chloride usually indicate a cause of excessive GI losses, especially upper GI, with volume depletion. The clinical picture can also be used to determine fluid status with increased urine osmolality, although this is less accurate. Fractional excretion of sodium is even more accurate than urine sodium in the setting of renal failure. Less than 1% can indicate hypovolemia and greater than 2% indicates acute tubular necrosis. In the absence of altered renal function, volume depletion is not indicated until you reach a fractional excretion of sodium less than or equal to 0.1%. Low serum uric acid and high urinary uric acid usually indicates SIADH. If you remember, uric acid secretion is increased with vasopressin or ADH receptor stimulation in the kidneys. These values would also be found in conditions of intravascular dehydration, but presumably you would have already ruled these out with the urine sodium. The serum bicarbonate and potassium can also be used to differentiate SIADH from intravascular volume depletion due to vomiting, diarrhea, or diuretic use. Excessive vomiting and diuretic abuse lead to metabolic alkalosis and hypokalemia. Alkalosis is a result of loss of gastric acids. Diarrhea causes metabolic acidosis and hypokalemia. The hypokalemia in both cases are from excessive potassium losses in GI secretions or through calureuresis. Metabolic acidosis and hyperkalemia may indicate primary adrenal insufficiency, as aldosterone causes the retention of sodium in exchange for potassium and hydrogen ion. A deficiency leads to conservation of potassium and hydrogen as an acid and loss of sodium. Most patients with SIADH will have a normal serum bicarbonate and potassium. Finally, I want to address when you should test for adrenal and or thyroid function. You should suspect cortisol deficiency in every case of SIADH. It may or may not be associated with signs of aldosterone deficiency concomitantly. Again, you should suspect aldosterone deficiency with metabolic acidosis, hyperkalemia, and high urine sodium. Additional cortisol deficiency may partially or completely correct the potassium and acidosis. Additionally, remember the clinical signs and history congruent with adrenal insufficiency, such as hemodynamic collapse, darkening of the skin, and recent steroid use. Hypothyroid often must be quite severe to be associated with hyponatremia. Urine osmolality will be high. It may share features with intravascular dehydration causes or SIADH. Thyroid function should be tested when you can't otherwise find a cause for hyponatremia, especially if the patient presents as clinically consistent with hypothyroid. The most important distinction you can make for treatment is identification of reversible causes and reversal. Medications, adrenal insufficiency, hypothyroid, and polydipsia are examples of this. Next, you will need to consider volume status. Euvolemic and hypervolemic types are treated with fluid restriction first. Hypovolemic is treated with normal saline infusion. Know when to treat. Asymptomatic patients with sodium greater than or equal to 120 should be left alone. Asymptomatic patients with sodium less than 110 should be corrected slowly. Patients with severe neurological symptoms such as seizures, stroke symptoms, or somnolence usually require treatment with hypertonic saline, regardless of how low their sodium is, as long as they are indeed hyponatremic. Remember hyponatremia in your differential when considering nausea, confusion, headache, and lethargy. And keep in mind that no formula for sodium correction has been validated. The only way you will know you're not correcting too fast is to check the serum sodium levels again and again. If you overcorrect it, fix it. Osmotic demyelination syndrome will not show symptoms until it is far too late and is almost always irreversible. Thank you.